A good 10 years ago, the producer and myself were living in Hanoi in the north of Vietnam, living and working there. And we would travel to Laos a lot. We loved Laos, we loved the people, and we were fascinated by a country which, you know, the most bombed place on the planet per capita, but with these people who are so full of fun and energy and who would embrace you as foreigners in such a lovely way. And basically, one night in a bar, we met some bomb disposal specialists. And we drank a lot of beer with them, and we talked to them, and we thought, this is really interesting. These fellas are so full of contradictions. They're ex-army, but now they're cleaning up bombs, and they're funny, and they're kind of reinventing themselves on every level. And we thought, well, this is a really interesting way into finding more about the secret war, which we knew very little about. We thought, well, we're educated. You know, I've been to university. No one ever told me about this part of the Vietnam War. So we thought this is a good place to make a film from. They're terrific characters, and it will be a way to draw an audience, a slightly more popular audience, into a documentary. And so we made the film Bomb Harvest. And that took... Look, if you make a film in a socialist or communist country like Laos, you have to spend a good year or two basically being entrusted into the place and with permissions, and the whole community knows about you and no one will talk to you. You know, inside those places, it's very suspicious of foreigners. So we had to spend a good couple of years basically meeting everyone and making friends with people, being entrusted. And then we made the film Bomb Harvest, which was just the producer, myself and a sound recordist. We were doing everything. I was shooting and directing, and Sylvia was producing, production, managing, doing some sound. And we spent a lot of time with a bomb disposal team. Now, the main character of Bomb Harvest was an Anglo-Australian. It was an ABC documentary. And the response to the film was very much, look, there was a sub-narrative in the film, which is the kids who collect the bomb scrap metal.
Yeah, of course.
And these kids... I mean, every time I worked with them, Sylvia and I felt incredibly emotional, and we felt these kids are, you know, they're 6, 7, 8 years old, and they're putting food on the table by selling bomb scrap, collecting bombs, and selling it for metal. And at the end of making that film, as wonderful as the Australian bomb disposal specialist character was, emotionally we felt very drawn to the kids, and the international response was, next time, it should be a Lao protagonist, and why not make it a Lao child? And the Lao community in Australia and in Laos said, look, we don't have a... collaborators that we'd worked with in the previous film said, look, we don't have a funded, established industry in Laos. If we don't collaborate and make this together, it won't happen, or at least not now. So we collaborated with Pauline Puminda, who's our Lao Australian associate producer. Again, we'd worked with her with Bomb Harvest, and we collected a team of Lao, Thai and Australians, and we seeded the film The Rocket. But it was a long period of writing and development as well, and trying to work out what story do we tell.
On stage you told how many bombs are lying now. Yes. I would like to have the number again.
The number again. Well, it's estimated that there were 2 million tons of bombs dropped. Basically, Laos was bombed every 8 minutes, 24 hours a day, for 9 years. So there's layer upon layer upon layer upon of bombs. And they estimate that a third of these didn't go off for a number of...
A third.
Oh, yeah. So a third of 2 million...
Because in Germany we have always bombs.
Similar story. You know, same.
But 50 years ago.
50 years ago, but very similar story. Yeah. And so a third of those bombs didn't go off for reasons why they were faulty, or in the rice paddies it's very soft, so the bomb goes into soft ground and doesn't detonate, or jam timers. They have little timers in them, tick, 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 and it gets stuck. And then stays till someone starts to hit the bomb or open it for the explosive, and then bomb goes off. again. Or they're the cluster bombs, which are these small bombs that you see in the film.
Yeah.
And the children think they're fruit or ball, and boom, and they die or they're maimed.
In this connection, also the question, how can they stand to have this rocket festival?
Yes.
Because after 9 years, I would think you can't hear it anymore.
Yeah. That's right. Well, I think, you know, the rocket festival is, as you see in the film, number one, it's asking for rain. And I love its irreverence. It's not saying, praying, saying, please bring me rain, please bring me rain. No, no, no. It's saying, hey, you bastards, you know, you rail on us, you know, and shooting rockets at the gods. So it's basically aggravating the gods. And it's lovely. It's irreverent. And even though it's Buddhist, it's a Buddhist festival and an ancient festival, it's also a kind of a venting of their history and a great metaphor for the country. You know, this is the most bombed country on the planet,
yes,
shooting back at the sky. And a lot of the people who build the rockets are ex-army because they have the knowledge of explosive. So it's an amazing experience. You see its whole history of the country there, its mythical history, its war history. And we thought, well, if we can find a personal story where all this becomes a metaphor for a great need, a human need that would transcend borders, a common need. You know, the boy's need is to be loved by his family. It's a simple need, a very simple need. So we thought if we can somehow put all this into a simple human need that transcends borders, then we're heading somewhere interesting. And especially if the themes, you know, the legacy of war and in terms of industry, and Australia is very much a part of this argument. We have a lot of industry in Laos and throughout Asia, and so does, you know, that theme is echoed through all of the developing world. There is a lot of first world industry.
I think so. And even with the water and electricity,
it's
horrible, but Australia doesn't say anything about
No, very little. It's kept very, very quiet, you know, and even recently there was a Tasmanian company, you know, we have our hands in gold, copper, all sorts of big industries. And it's most Australians don't even know that we have our hands in those sorts of... And there's CEOs on wages of $4-5 million a year, you know. So basically, there will always be business. There will always be relationships, economic relationships. But really, I guess our film is quietly trying to say that it's to give back a little bit more. Do they need so much profit, or can they give back just a little bit more? And there needs to be longer-term plans of compensation to people and the environment, you know. I mean, I've learned so much. This is the wonderful thing about filmmaking is I've had to learn, and I've been learning, and you keep learning. And one thing, you know, I've been learning about dams and what happens to the ecosystem, and that you've got to put sediment, you've got to let sediment through to keep the ecosystem alive, which feeds the fish, which feeds the organisms. And dams can do this. They can, if they do it right, they can keep rivers alive. But most of the time they think, well, that'll be at a cost. How much do I make? You know, so it's a lot of it is actually just about giving a little bit more back to people and the environment.
So you already had a feeling after 10 years being in Laos for the people and for the need of the people there.
Yeah.
So, and you found, have you already witnessed something of this relocation because of the dam works and something like that?
Yes, there's I mean, in even when we were making Bomb Harvest, we would see people being relocated all the time, deserted villages of valleys that would be dammed or people being moved, people homeless everywhere. And so it was already, we were witnessing it as we were making the documentary. And now there's 52 dams in planning in Little Laos. And it's a tiny, small country, you know. It's a lot of lot of huge dams in a very small country. And so you just wonder, what is going to happen at this rate? And I think currently, globally, there's 60 million people being relocated from dams alone. And, you know, that's just dams. Then there's every other type of industry, everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge global issue at the moment. And I don't know what will happen. But I hope, you know, there are there are filmmakers and writers and journalists who are trying to tell those stories.
Mm-hmm. So it's important.
It's important, you know. And if governments just take a little bit more of an aggressive approach, mm-hmm. also with developing countries, because as you know, money is handed over and where it ends up is a very difficult thing to track, and it always will be.
We see it in the movie. Yeah. You're going to have, you're going to be relocated, and this will be your new houses.
Yes,
Where are they?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that often there's people are told if you go here, you'll get this, this, and this, and then when people get there, the infrastructures just aren't there, and the buildings aren't there, and definitely there isn't long-term plans of education, of vocational development. Mm-hmm. For people to learn new skills, which is very important when you've got people who have existed in a certain way in the highlands and on certain diets, and suddenly you put them in a lowland situation,
of course,
where they can't be a farmer of something they've farmed for generations, and they're not eating the nutrition that they're used to. People get sick, people, and where there are a lot of lowland diseases, and water can be dirty because there isn't mm-hmm. proper sewage. And that is common of every developing country. It's a story
Africa
that's echoed everywhere. It's echoed through every developing country.
Coming to purple. Purple is a Hmong.
Purple is Hmong, yes.
Hmong, and yeah. He was forced to fight against Pol Pot.
Yes, that's right.
And he was a child soldier.
Child soldier, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, I mean, Laos has got this really interesting part of its history that the Hmong... there's always been factions between the lowland Lao and the Hmong, who are kind of the highland mountain people. And I guess the CIA were very clever. They thought, well, this is a secret war, and one way to keep the war secret is to not have Americans on the ground, because if you have an American casualty, people start to say, well, where did they die? They didn't die in Vietnam, so where are they dying?
Yeah.
No one knew it was happening in Laos. It was a secret war.
Mm-hmm.
So one way of keeping that a secret is not to have American casualties, or very few, and they basically employed the Hmong, and they were the casualties. Thousands and thousands died fighting with the Americans. And many of those were child soldiers. You know, they could be paid 10 cents a day. That was what they were paid, 10 cents a day, and they were expendable. You know, they were given automatic weapons. And Purple, I guess, is a, he's a product of that. He's a boy who was trained with GIs, and with that came wonderful American popular culture.
James Brown,
you know, so with the bad comes the good. And everyone in the film is based off real people.
Yeah,
so this is based off a real character as
when
well.
When he looks himself in the television,
yeah,
he has danced in the
yes,
film yeah. in Laos or
yes.
in America. He has been to America too. No,
in my backstory,
yeah.
you know, people can put whatever story they
yeah,
want. That's
course.
The lovely thing about a film. But in my backstory, I had that he'd never been to America.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And we actually had a scene that will probably be in the deleted scenes on the DVD one day, which was about, it happened in that bombed village, mm-hmm. and there's a scene in there where they get ambushed by Hmong rebels, and you find out more about Purple, and that he was, and he has this connection with these other soldiers, but we took the scene out.
Mm-hmm.
We took the scene out. It wasn't, look, for a number of reasons, it was a night scene, and we originally had scheduled three nights to film it, because it was late night and the children would get tired.
Mm.
And we ended up with one night. You know, our film is a relatively low budget film.
And, yeah, how much?
The budget was 2.4 million Australian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which for, you know, a big overseas thing, and there's explosions and visual effects, and it's not a lot of money for a film like that. So, you know, in the end, we took the scene out. I just didn't think the actors were quite there, wasn't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And in a funny sort of way, the film started becoming much more about Purple, and we wanted the film to remain very closely with the children. So a hard decision because it had a lot of good elements about it, but that's filmmaking. You know, you keep writing till the very last day.
Oh, and the shooting, how long it was, and then you are.
Okay. The shooting was about 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm. In a row? Was there a lot of rain and breaks?
Well, it was funny enough, you know, one decision we made very early was we wanted part of a real rocket festival in mm-hmm. the film.
Yeah.
So, and the producer was very adamant about that, and she's very clever in that way. So we got a little bit of funding, and I went to Laos with the mm-hmm. DOP, and we shot at a real rocket festival.
Yeah.
But on a good, you know, high-end camera. And then I took all that footage, and I storyboarded. I got all the best moments, and I rewrote the script into those best moments. So, you know, when the rocket goes sideways and things happen, and I rewrote and I storyboarded mm-hmm. a new story. And then 6 months later, when all those best bits had already been filmed in a real festival, we then started putting our characters into sort of micro scenes, and we refilmed at the same location, but with a constructed rocket festival that we had a few rockets. We only had a few. You know, didn't have that many extras. And so it was hard work, a tricky thing to do. But what it means is we've got footage of a real community firing at the sky and real reactions and real chaos.
And looking like that.
Yeah, looking. And it's you know, there's some good stuff in there.
Documentary.
It's documentary, so there's real energy in there. And there's the real people of Laos, you know, firing these rockets, asking for rain, but also firing them back at the sky. And so it was a risky thing to do, mm-hmm. but I think important in the end. So we filmed that. 6 months later, we came back and did an 8-week shoot with the actors and rebuilt those scenes to cut together. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But no breaks because of heavy rain, something like that?
Well, we had to basically, you're right. What we did was when we filmed Bomb Harvest, we filmed at the hottest time of year and it ended in the monsoon. And that was really difficult. So this time around, we thought we have to film in the dry part of the year. Because, you know, as you know, with a shoot, every day is costing you thousands of dollars. And on a low-budget film, if you start to lose days, the crew still needs to be paid. Mm. Hotels need to be paid. Per diems need to be paid. Everyone is still paid. So on a low-budget film, if you start to lose days, it's disaster. Mm. And on a film like this, which is so much exterior locations, we didn't have a lot of backup plans, hardly any interiors. So we had to film at the driest part of the dry season. And luckily, I think we only got one day of rain in 8 weeks. And then we reconstructed. The rain at the end is all reconstructed. Yeah.
What I like very much is the little girl coming in and being so very clever and tell the boy what he's wrong. Don't drink that water.
Yeah.
How stupid are you? Yeah. And so on. I really liked her. Yes. When did she come up?
Well, she, you know, casting took a long time for obvious reasons. You know, we had to find the right. I think unless you cast right, a film can't work. It just can't work. You know, you're already actually making it go wrong. So we looked for months. We looked in schools. We looked in temples. We looked around streets and drama groups, youth groups. And then I'd been working with a casting agent as well in Thailand, and she's terrific, and she helped us find the boy in the end. But she'd also shown I'd done lots of screen tests and seen lots of material of all sorts of actresses, young actresses, who were actually Isan, which is the Lao migrants to Thailand, who speak a dialect of Lao. And then I travelled to Laos. Excuse me, I'll just have a little. And then I travelled to Laos, and we looked everywhere, and we came across her in a small drama group on next to Vientiane, which is the capital of Laos. Mm. And I, you know, with casting, what I do is I often just shoot a lot of documentary footage, just observe people. Because I think with newer actors, ultimately you want who they are. Mm-hmm. You know, the acting is just giving them circumstances, a new narrative in a way. But so I filmed a lot of documentary, and the more I filmed her, the more I could see that she lived very strongly through thought, and her imagination. And I think in cinema, so much of the unspoken is really important that you can read through eyes. And she was also tough. You know, she was hanging out with all the boys and they'd climb the tree that high, she'd climb the tree higher. They'd kick footballs around and she'd kick it harder. And she was just tough and she had a very strong sense of self. And then I screen tested to see how she would deal with, you know, just thought and loss and accessing something more internal. And she did it so beautifully. And we then looked at more people in the north of Thailand and I said to the person who was helping with the casting, we're wasting time. She's perfect, absolutely perfect. But, you know, what happens with casting, as you know, is that you rewrite as you go, you find people and you look at your script again and you think, well, I can't really jam them into the script, but I can change the script. So I was constantly rewriting
from day to day?
Day to day, yeah. Okay. Even right through the shoot, gave everyone the shits totally. But I think it's the only way to go with newer actors as well, is you mould the script to who they are as people.
And I'm interested in the boy. Yeah. I like his laugh.
Yes, gorgeous.
And I read he is from the street in the end.
Yep.
And I asked myself, when he is in such a tender relationship with his film mother, how it was for him and how you directed this.
With the boy?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, again, it's one of those things of when we met him, we start to think, this boy is terrific. And and he aligned very well with Arlo because he was a street kid. He's a survivor. And day to day, he has to fix things, get things to work. He's got to eat. Life's got to move forward. So we thought, look, he's kind of perfect for the character. But the next thing we had to try and get to was whether he'd share something internal with us, something of his hurt. And because he was a street kid, he didn't want to. He was tough. But I liked his toughness, and I liked that he wasn't sentimental. You know, he's not sentimental. He just tries to fix things.
And fun,
you know. He just has fun, and he tries to move forward. So then we had to just do extensive rehearsals and screen tests until we could see whether he'd want to start sharing more of himself. And he did. He started to share. Mm-hmm. As, you know, again, it was a long period of trust and sharing, and then he started to share, and that was really exciting. And we thought, that's it, he's cast, we'll all go on this journey together.
Yeah. Where is he today?
He is in the hotel. They've just arrived 2 days ago, you know, when they saw the snow coming down, they started clapping. They've never seen snow before. And
there was his foster mother on the stage.
That's
right?
His foster mother. And she's lovely. Bua, her name's Bua, and she's, you know, everything he cares about now is Bua. She really looks after him very well.
One thing about the mystical background, we have some religion and mystical background because of the evil twin, good twin.
Yeah.
Where does this come from?
Well, in the film, it's a people called the Akka. And they believe, well, not all of them believe. I mean, that's the thing. It's like any religion. You've got different levels of belief. And some of the traditional people still believe that basically...
belongs to tribes, but...
Yeah, it's a tribe. It's a tribe. Yeah. It's a mountain. Oh, okay. It's a mountain people called the Akka, originally from...
It's a tribe.
Yeah, okay. Called the Akka. And they believe that basically one of two twins is no good. But you don't know which one is no good, so you're better off getting rid of both of them. But not everyone believes this anymore. You know, like in any any belief system, you know, newer generations are saying we don't want this anymore. But some of the older people are saying they still believe this.
But you have the monuments, the Buddha statues, twin statues in the water.
Yes.
Why did you put it in?
Well, we actually didn't construct this. This is in a... Look, the single head we put in the water because I wanted to have a face, it's very subtle, I know, that looked like the mother. So this it's similar to the mother. But the two heads is real. This is sunken, a real temple in a dam lake. And these things are still lying on the bottom, bits of temples. So that's not constructed. I wanted to go and film... in a real temple. So the film is very much a mixture of almost documentary footage and dramatized footage. So
how did you discover them?
A lot of research, and then a lot of time trying to get access to places. It's a big producing job, that film. For a low budget film, mm-hmm. It was difficult. But I think those things are important in the end. You know, that you do find the legitimate places, and you feel them. You know, some of that underwater material. It's dirty. It's murky. It's real. And you know, I love that about it.
So I think we have to finish.
No, okay, thank you.
Good luck for you and good luck for the film.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. What's the game?